Hi everyone, it's producer Bryn again. This is the second of two previously unreleased episodes, which were far too good not to share. Again, some of the details might be a little bit out of date, but the content and the main message are still excellent. So if you've been missing the team, they'll be back very soon with some brand new stuff. So watch this space and make sure you tell your friends and colleagues to subscribe so they don't miss out either. Producer Bryn, out.
Back to another fantastic episode of Somewhere in Between, the AIT and First Five Careers podcast brought to you by the RCGP. My name is LJ. I'm joined by Kim, who had the pleasure of speaking with Liam Loftus about his experience of leadership as a GP trainee. So enjoy their interview, and we'll be discussing some of the highlights on the other side.
So I am delighted to be joined today by Liam Loftus, who is somebody I've known for how long now? A couple of years?
At least a couple of years, I think.
We've only met once, yeah. Which was at the RCGP conference in Liverpool, where I wasn't feeling my best because I'd accidentally booked accommodation in the worst possible street in Liverpool if you're trying to get any sleep. Skinner Street, for anybody that knows Liverpool. It was like sleeping in a club. I'd managed to book that for the entirety of my eight kind of GP trainees and my cohort. So they weren't best pleased with me that night, but it was cheap for a reason. So I'm delighted to welcome Liam. And I'm not going to introduce him because I think he can introduce himself. But he is a GP trainee, and we're going to talk today about our experience of leadership. We're both a couple of people who've done a little bit around leadership. In the context of sort of being GP trainees, or in my case, a recently qualified GP, and what that means for the future. So we hope you enjoy it. And Liam, I'll let you introduce yourself.
No, thanks, Kim. It's a pleasure to join you this afternoon. So as you say, I'm Liam. I'm a GP trainee. I'm based in Cambridge. I'm just about to start ST3 in the next couple of weeks. And as you say, I've had sort of quite an interest in leadership that sort of developed looking back probably through medical school, through F1, F2, and now into my sort of GP training. So I've been sort of fortunate enough to do lots of very sort of ground up projects in the areas which I've been working, through to some regional work, through to sort of national fellowship posts as well. So it's something I've enjoyed a great deal, and no doubt we'll talk about this afternoon.
Oh, brilliant. Great. Thanks, Liam. Well, I feel very privileged to have you on the podcast. Liam has done a lot of podcasts and things recently, but after all your exciting work that you've done in the last year that we'll get onto. But I guess I want to take it right back to the start and how you first got involved in leadership and what motivated you to do that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, so starting out really, I was doing lots of things that now looking back would be classed as leadership, but at the time I didn't really recognize it as such. So even throughout sort of, let's say, medical school, I found myself looking at things around me and thinking, oh, well, that isn't quite working as it should, or that could probably be a little bit better. Why don't I go ahead and have a stab at trying to fix it? And that was generally non-clinical stuff, to be honest. That was a lot of medical student society and sports type stuff and things like this. It sort of stemmed from just looking around and thinking maybe that could be a little bit better. So that's how I started getting involved in improvement, I guess you would call it. And then as my sort of training progressed, I started as a junior doctor, F1, F2, I sort of transferred that subconsciously in a way to the places in which I was working. So the wards and the hospital, the GP practice I worked in as an F2. And again, looking around thinking, oh, maybe that could be slightly better. Maybe I have a go at doing it. At the time, I really didn't think that was leadership. I just thought that was something that you do maybe as a little bit of an extra to your day job. But actually, that's kind of what leadership is almost all about for me nowadays. It is not necessarily a sort of a title that you have or a position that you hold. It is just anyone, anywhere, taking a look around and saying, well, I actually think I could do something to make things better for me, for my colleagues, but also for my patients too. And I found that as something that's quite interesting, quite exciting in a way, and trying to make a change that is hopefully long lasting and improves things for the people alongside me and that will follow me. That's how I sort of got into it. There's no sort of big turning point or no all of a sudden, okay, now I'm doing leadership. It's more a gradual thing. And it took some time to realize that's what leadership actually was. I don't know if you've had a similar different experience or.
Yeah, no, I can completely relate to that, actually. I agree that, look, at the time, I probably didn't realize it was leadership. But and if you'd asked me at the time, do you have any leadership experience, Kim, or are you doing a leadership role? I'd have gone, no. But actually, when you look back at kind of what the qualities of leadership are, then yeah, in hindsight, I probably was. So I mean, what examples have I got? I guess I was on the mess committee as a junior doctor, because I wanted to make sort of life as a junior doctor in the DGH that I worked in better. And I was part of a committee and I really enjoyed that. And then I guess I worked in quite a challenging trust at the time and was asked to get involved, or kind of volunteered to get involved in a piece of work looking at how they could make life as a junior doctor in that hospital, particularly for the foundation doctors, better. And then I guess the turning point for me was, I guess, getting increasingly frustrated. I think when I was doing ACCS training, it's sort of things wrong, I guess. And I guess I was one of those people that loved a bit of a rant and loved a bit of a moan, and eventually decided to turn that into something positive by applying for a Darzi fellowship, where I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and get trained up on how you actually deal with these things and how do you change things and how do you make things better. And that was my turning point, really. But yeah, I can completely relate to everything that you said there about it. You really look back and you've been doing this a while. What was your turning point though, Liam? When did this sort of start to become more formal?
Oh, good question. I think probably, as I say, I started out with a lot of sort of ground up projects in the area that I was working in. And I found that actually I'm enjoying these so much, to the point where, although it's taking time and energy, it's also giving me some energy to go back and take to my clinical work. And I guess the turning point for me was when I thought, well, actually, wouldn't it be really nice, rather than doing all of this stuff in my spare time, to actually have a bit of protected and ideally paid time in order to do it? So I guess looking back, I moved to the east of England, to Cambridge, about just over 3 years ago now, to start GP training. And within the first few months, a leadership fellowship post came up within the region. And that was essentially a day a week post to support other junior doctors in the area, develop some of their leadership skills. So a sort of leadership development role. And that was quite a sort of change in mindset to me, because all of a sudden I had one day a week which I could dedicate not only to some of this work and trying to develop others around me, but also it was a very developmental role in and of itself, with a lot of support provided and a lot of education and training provided specifically on leadership. So that was almost a sort of a step up from these informal ground up things to actually now having that role, having that protected time, and also, I guess, the responsibility and the accountability that comes with it. That was quite a big shift, a shift I really enjoyed, to be honest, to the point where I went from that one day a week post through to taking a full year out to do a full-time leadership post and on a national program, to again sort of immerse myself even further in that. So yeah, it's a couple of turning points in there, but it's been a sort of gradual transition to now, where the point I've almost come back sort of full circle, when I'm back into GP training. I'm spending 3 days a week in clinical training, 60%, and then the rest of my week, the sort of 40% doing some of this leadership work. So having one alongside the other, and actually finding a really nice balance for me at the moment.
Oh, no, that's great to hear. And it's amazing, isn't it, how you open one small door and it leads to an awful lot of others.
I completely agree.
It's a domino effect.
I was gonna ask you about that. So you obviously done lots of different things over the past few years. What did you feel like that was something that was really like mapped out and you always knew what you wanted to do within medical leadership, or was it almost sort of opportunistic? What do you think?
Yeah, I think for me it's very much opportunistic, actually. I've always taken on a role not really knowing where it's going to go or what it's going to lead to next, but just knowing, do you know what, that's something a bit different, that's something I'm quite interested in, I'll say yes to that. And then before you know it, further down the line, you know somebody you've met during that opportunity, or someone that's recognized that you've done that opportunity, says, oh, actually we've got XYZ, would you be interested? And it's amazing how it really is a bit of a catalyst, and you just but I think fundamentally, as you said, you have to enjoy it. And you do need to put in that legwork at the start to maybe do it in your extra time, to take on extra things. But as you said, for me, it's always been something I've enjoyed doing. So it's always been, it's complemented the clinical work that I've done by kind of being able to spend my time or invest in making improvements and making things better. It's then in turn made me enjoy the clinical aspect of my job better. And so the two have always complemented it for me, and I think that's what's kind of led for me to perhaps spend a bit more of my own time doing it.
No, really interesting. So I think this is a particularly interesting area, the sort of how people end up where they are within medical leadership, so to speak. So it's a question we sort of commonly ask very senior leaders within the NHS through Next Generation GP. One of the questions we always ask is, so how do you get, how have you got to where you are now? And I'm always really struck by the responses. What I expect to hear is, okay, so I knew when I was 25 that I wanted to be the chief exec of X, and then I gradually worked my way up to that. But that never happens, essentially. Yeah. What they always say was, I looked around, I saw that I wanted to improve things in X, Y, and Z. I had a go at it. I had a decent job. Someone asked me to do something else as a result of it. And then all of a sudden they bounce through all of these different areas in a way that is almost unpredictable, to finding themselves where they are now in these sort of crazy, very senior leadership positions. And I was kind of like, I sit there as a junior doctor, as a trainee, thinking, oh, does it really happen like that? Surely there must have been a bit of a plan, or surely there must have been, you know, something a bit more to it. But actually, even now, I'm only like 5 years out of med school. I'm still very sort of early on this journey, so to speak. But actually, I start to see that come out already. It's the, you don't necessarily need to have a long-term aim. You don't necessarily need to know exactly what the next 6-12 months are going to look like. Because if you spot something around you, you try to change it, you do a decent job at it, there will be other people who notice and like, well, why don't you come and try this with me, or why don't you work on this with this person? Like it's a lot less predictable than say, oh, I'm going to do general practice training and this year I'll be an ST1 and next year I'll be an ST2. Like, leadership doesn't work in the same way as medical training, at least in my view.
No, I agree with you. And it's very much not about kind of the end goal. For me in particular, it's just been about gaining skills, I guess, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I'd really be interested. An example being sort of, I thought, I've never worked at NHS England. I've never worked at kind of a national body. I'm going to apply for that specialised commissioning job and just see if I get it. And it's okay to be rejected. And I've applied for many things that I've been rejected for. but actually, the world of leadership is quite small. And I think people love a bit of passion and a bit of a yes person. And if you're keen and you're interested and you're willing to put some time in, people will appreciate that.
I completely agree.
And you, Liam, went and did, as you mentioned previously, the National Medical Directors Clinical Fellowship last year, which we ought to talk about because it's very prestigious, it's very interesting, and you really made the most of that year. Are you able to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was so fortunate to have one of the most incredible years I've had, working as a full-time National Medical Directors Clinical Fellow. I was based at NHS England. I was based in the primary care team. And this was essentially between September of 2021 and August of 2022. And that was a really interesting time for general practice, as it was for the whole of the health system. Lots of challenges around things like workforce. Of course, during that time, we had a huge Omicron wave as well to deal with, which didn't help things. But that in itself, that fellowship opportunity was a chance to remove yourself completely from clinical medicine, to immerse yourself full time in this sort of policy space at a national level, where you're almost taken out of training and dropped into one of these national organizations at the highest of levels, working alongside people who are incredibly inspirational. They're the people who you often see doing national webinars or you read about on the news. Then all of a sudden you've gone from being a GP trainee one day to working alongside them the next, and that in itself was absolutely fascinating. It was incredible to be a part of so much of the sort of policy type work, to see day to day what the challenges are that we face at a national level, and what type of things that we can do as individuals and teams to try and do our best to fix those. It was a really good opportunity to actually get a much better understanding of how we work as a healthcare system. It's often you speak to lots of people about this, they'll tell you how complex the NHS is. And after spending a year full time in it working in policy, I can't say I've fully understand it, but I've got a much better grasp now about how all of these different pieces fit together. And also, again, it was a really good, something you've talked about, a really good developmental opportunity as well. So ultimately, we're still at the early stages of our careers, with hopefully a long, fulfilling and sustainable career ahead of us. Having that protected time and opportunity to sort of develop some of these skills, to learn from others and to learn by doing as well, is it feels so fortunate to be able to do that. And I've kind of come back to clinical training in the past couple of months with a whole lot more energy for my clinical work and also my leadership work too. So yeah, ultimately an incredible experience.
Oh no, you and we'll come on to the big GP consult, because I'm sure people have heard about that, and that is you and a group of people are very much the brains behind that. But I think it's important to talk about the benefit of a fellowship year. So I agree with you entirely. It gives you just the most amazing headspace where you can actually just focus on this leadership year rather than having to kind of spin too many plates and do it alongside a portfolio and clinical training and exams and all the rest of it. But you don't have to. You don't have to take a year out. There are lots of opportunities that you can do alongside training. Tell us more about this big GP consult, because it is really exciting.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's essentially a piece of work that I've been co-leading over the past 12 months with an incredible team. There's about 10 of us. We were all National Medical Director Clinical Fellows across over the past 12 months, all based at different organisations, national organisations, but all come together because we have an interest in general practice. Many of us were GP trainees, and I get a sort of specific interest in what that future looks like. So we decided very sort of separately to our fellowship role, so in our own time and independent of all these organizations we were working at, we would try and do something together just as a group of trainees who are looking to the future and thinking about what does the future of general practice look like, particularly at a time of so much change and uncertainty in some ways. So as I say, a team of 10 of us came together and thought, well, how can we engage GP trainees, early career GPs around the country, and ask them the question, so what does the future of general practice look like to you, and what steps can we all take together in order to get there? So we ended up hosting sort of five evening webinars early this year, early in 2022, very sort of structured discussions, breakout rooms on very specific elements of the future of general practice. So the clinical care that we offer, what our role is in society, in our environment, how do we fit with the other structures of the system that we work alongside? And then as a result, we produced our big GP consultation final report, which you can see on our website. And that pulls together all of the incredible insight we heard from well over 100 GP and GP trainees around the country, pulls together all of this insight, but also importantly, all of the ideas that they had for what the future looks like. And those ideas that fell out almost sort of fit into a few buckets. There are things that you can do very locally within your own practice to work towards a more positive future. There are things that are best done at regional level, say within deaneries or within integrated care boards. And then things that you can do nationally. So some of our national organisations, NHS England, obviously GP, to give some examples, what sort of things could they be doing to try and work towards this future? And basically took all of the ideas and insight from that and then tried to work with the organisations at local, regional and national level to bring a bit of this to life. And I think on that it's been incredibly well received by all of the organisations that we've worked with. They've seen this as a real attempt to try and pull together a coherent view of what the future could look like and what steps we could take to get there, and some real tangible ideas that we could work together to put into place. So it's been an amazing opportunity to meet lots of people, to work with a brilliant team on this, and also to just have all of those insight and ideas in one place with a view to trying to take it forward, really.
Oh, really exciting. It's such an amazing piece of work. We're not going to go into too much detail right now because it's a good document, which is really important. So I would urge everybody to go and read it. Excuse me, 2 seconds. I've lost my train of thought. Go and read it because we haven't got time to go into the detail of it. But for you, Liam, what do you? I mean, so there's a lot of negativity around the world of GP at the moment. I've recently qualified. You're sort of coming about to enter ST3. It can be a little bit all doom and gloom. And I think what was really great about your piece of work was it was the first time, to my knowledge, that a group of very sort of more junior people in the world of GP have come together to say, actually, this is what we think the future of GP looks like. And it is the more junior generation where changes now need to be made for our generation. There's no point people at the end of their career deciding what the future of GP looks like. It's actually our generation that needs to do it. And that's what I think was brilliant about your piece of work. But what in terms of you personally, what do you think, from all the learning that you've done, from all the experiences you've had, what do you think needs to happen for you to enjoy your job as a GP in post-CCT life?
Oh, really, really good question. And I'll try and within that, I'll try and give my view, but also reflect some of the stuff we heard through the big GP consultation, because it was really, really interesting. I think almost that the overarching theme that came out of this was that yes, that there we are under a lot of pressure. There are some huge challenges at the moment. But looking to the future, if we're going to work towards a more positive future, it's probably going to be impossible for us to do so as an individual practice that doesn't look beyond our practice. There's almost a real sort of desire to collaborate and work together rather than against each other, and to try and tackle some of these challenges that we know we face. So in terms of what people felt that looked like in practice, so there's lots of talk about the positive aspects of collaborating within your practice. So a real feeling that the days of the GP that does absolutely everything 24/7 without a break, that those days aren't sustainable for the generation coming through, and that won't lead to a career that lasts 40 years. That'll be a career that lasts a couple of years before we burn out. So that, alongside the fact that a real sort of openness and a desire really to work alongside a multidisciplinary team, firstly and foremost, to offer better care to our patients and the people that we serve. But secondly, to increase sustainability of the job as well. The fact that if you've got a team of skilled professionals that's multidisciplinary, you can quite often offer continuity of care, team-based continuity of care. So a patient will get to know a certain number of professionals with a wide skill mix within the practice. And it means you're not relying on being in that practice 24/7 in order to offer that care to the patient when they really need it. So something about that, the fact that we're moving away from a one single GP does everything for the patient in front of them, more towards a team-based approach. But then I think secondly, and again on the point of collaboration, that thinking a bit beyond our four walls in general practice towards, how can we work first and foremost with the practices alongside us in order to offer care at maybe a higher level, so to speak. So primary care networks being a really good example of that. How can we work more closely with organisations, whether that be the secondary care trust, right the way through to up to the level of integrated care boards, and thinking, well, how can we smooth the barriers that we know exist between those organisations, and how can we make sure we're all working together towards a shared common goal rather than sometimes quite competitively or even combatively in some places? And thirdly, how can we work with people who we've not necessarily worked with before, but know can have huge impact on health and well-being in our community? So what that specifically would be the likes of our voluntary community and social enterprise sector. We know at a local level there are many incredible organizations doing incredible things for our patients and our communities. But generally, the links between us as a general practice and them as a voluntary community, social enterprise sector organization haven't always existed. I kind of picked up through our work a bit of excitement to actually think, well, yeah, we could do things quite innovatively, could do things a bit differently. And that's an opportunity. I think the final thing, I'm conscious I'm talking a lot.
It's all great stuff.
The final thing I would say, and that came through really clearly in this work, is that, yes, okay, there are lots of challenges. There is doom and gloom around at the moment. But it does feel like there's a general feeling, particularly amongst trainees and early career GPs, that the future that we have, our future, is something that will be decided for us, and it'll be done to us in a way, in a quite a sort of passive way, that the future will happen to me whether I do something about it or not. I think what's become quite clear to me through some of this leadership work is that actually within general practice, we're so lucky that we have so much autonomy and so much power in order to change that future for ourselves. The future is very much in our hands in a way that we can shape it into something we think is positive for us and our patients, rather than it being something that happens to us. And that's something that I firmly believe is true locally, regionally, and nationally as well. So it's pulling all of this together. Yes, we've got the ideas for the future, but also, yes, we have a whole load of opportunity to shape this future for ourselves. That was a really sort of key thing that came out of the work for me.
Oh, no, I mean, there's so much to talk about there, but it's but I agree with, it's so exciting that this piece of work's been done, and that there, and you know, if you're ever feeling kind of like a little bit kind of a bit of doom and gloom about the world of GP, go and speak to some people who are passionate about it and are passionate about changing that, because actually that you need to find your yes people and find your like-minded people that are going to make this career the best it can possibly be.
I think you're right, Kim, and don't get me wrong, this is not to gloss over any of the challenges. They came through front and centre, and if you read the report, if you watch some of our videos, you will see that they are very much the drivers for change, that there are challenges right now and we need to do something about this. Mm-hmm. So that this is not to gloss over any of that, but also the vision that our participants put forward was purposefully one that is very positive and very future looking and very, if we could design general practice right now, how would we design it? And that's, I would love to sit here and say, well, it's so easy, it's so simple, we've got the vision, we just need to do X, Y, Z and make it happen. Like the reality is that there are some bits in that may be quite easy to achieve. There are some bits that are much harder. Mm-hmm. But I think the real positive thing is that this has been put on the table, and that people have said, well, they spoke with a really sort of collective voice that surprised me in a way. I was thinking we're going to get a whole spectrum of views that are directly conflicting with each other. But no, our participants generally came together and said, well, all of these things are very sensible. There are all these steps that we can take to work towards it. Some bits will be harder than others, but it feels like we've got a bit of a direction here that we'd like to head in. So yeah, positive in that sense, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's very clear, isn't it, that we cannot continue doing the same things. We have to change the way we do things. We can't expect to deliver GP care now, you know, in the same way we did 30 years ago and to get the correct outcomes. You know, conditions have moved on, expectations have moved on, demands have moved on. And it's not just about technology changing. We've got to kind of change the system to go with that. So, you know, what you talked about in terms of preventative health, working more with communities, and what that looks like, I guess, is very different depending on where in the country you work. For instance, currently I work in Brixton, you know, huge, massive inequality, huge amounts of poverty. What GP care looks like in Brixton is very different to what GP care looks like in the Lake District, which is where I'm from originally. Indeed. So, yeah, it's very exciting, but as you say, it's not something that's going to be changed overnight. But the beauty of a GP is that you can really have a role in sort of in how you deliver care and a real voice in it to make that difference. I guess one thing we haven't spoken about is sort of what a GP week should look like. And I know for me, Liam, I get quite frustrated that it is expected, you know, this whole narrative in the news about part-time GPs. And how we're all part-time and that's the problem and that's what's caused the problems with the NHS. When actually it fascinates me that there's no way that our A&E or anaesthetic colleagues would be expected to do 5 full clinical days a week. Yet in GP, that's, you know, 5 full clinical days is what's expected of a GP. And for me, I'm more than willing to work 5 days a week, but I can't do 5 full clinical days. It would actually absolutely break me. So for me, it's about trying to kind of, I personally think we need to make job plans for GPs that involve different aspects that give you the headspace to kind of think, do you know what, I'm working in this practice. This isn't working very well. Actually, here's half a day a week where you've got an opportunity to kind of change things and change the way we do things and maybe another half day teaching, and that's all factored into a full-time job. What are your thoughts on that in terms of what you want your future kind of 9 to 5 to look like when you finish?
Yeah, no, great question. And I think what you've sort of put across there as your view was very representative of what we heard from participants around the country in the big GP consultation. I think the first thing to say was there was a lot of frustration with the narrative around part-time GP working. Oh, that GPs, they work 3 days a week. That's part-time. I think the reality of the situation for many GPs who work 3 days a week is that they're working 12-hour plus days each day, which when you add all of that up, comes to the equivalent of a full-time job in most sectors. So one sort of specific point we had was that actually we talk about GP sessions, this sort of concept of sessions of a 4-hour 10-minute block that in reality is never 4-hour 10 minutes. So one specific I wanted to mention was that they our participants quite strongly called for a move away from sessions as this concept that nobody really understands and doesn't happen in practice towards hours worked, which is generally what most sectors use. And actually, if you add up all of the hours worked that these so-called labelled part-time GPs work, you'll find that a lot of them are working full-time, if not more. So there's that element. But then there's what does the week look like? And I think what you mentioned around, I think it'd be impossible to work 5 days a week clinically. That's something we heard quite strongly, again, from all participants. There was one comment that really sort of struck me and has stuck with me around flexibility and the need to promote flexibility in working hours in order to keep hold of our profession. And that I remember one participant saying that a flexible GP is better than no GP at all. And that's sort of taking into account that there are some people who... many people who can't work full 5 days a week for various reasons, whether that be caring responsibilities, for example, but still want to be an active and important part of the GP workforce. So how can we think differently? How can we promote flexibility in clinical work in order to, again, empower these people to stay within the profession for the amount of clinical work that they feel most appropriate for them. And also alongside that as well, you'll find that a lot of people who work maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 sessions clinically per week are quite often alongside that doing these other roles that we've talked about. So leadership being one of them, research, education, developing the next generation of our GPs and medical workforce. These are absolutely crucial things in order to deliver patient care. And we can't lose sight of that as well. We need to work towards a system that values the balance of both of those. Mm-hmm. I know you asked me specifically, what do you think my week looks like? For me at the moment, I'm really enjoying working 3 days clinically and 2 days non-clinically in some of these leadership roles. As I touched upon before, that gives me a good balance. My leadership work gives me the energy to take back to my clinical work and vice versa. And then in those leadership spaces, I feel like I'm there as a practicing clinician. I can represent the views. I can sort of represent what my week looks like and what my day-to-day looks like as a clinician. But I can also relate to how any policy decisions will impact upon patients, because I can say, well, you know what, that patient I saw yesterday, it would work really well for, but the one I saw on Monday, it wouldn't, and we need to rethink this. So moving forward, I really like this balance of clinical and non-clinical, and that's something I will likely be striving for over the next couple of years as well.
No, exactly the same over here.
Wonderful.
I'm happy to do a full-time job. You know, I'm in a stage in my life at the moment where I can do a full-time job, and I'm more than happy to do that. But I do think it's ridiculous that overall the expectation on GPs is that you either need to do sort of 3 days and then find other things and try and match them, or the expectation, you know, I mean, it's just, I don't know, very few people that work 10, you know, 5 full days, 10 sessions a week clinical. I don't think you'd ever expect a consultant in any specialty to do that. They've all got kind of SPA time factored in, and GPs don't get that. And I think that's perhaps one way of allowing people to perhaps continue to work clinically without having to, you know, experience burnout and reduce their number of sessions purely just for their own kind of sanity, and to try and obtain some form of work-life balance. So watch this space. Who knows, with the creation of sort of integrated care boards and perhaps more integrated care, maybe this is something that can be addressed. And so that the, you know, I think we've both spoken about how GP ultimately has ridiculous numbers of opportunities. I mean, so I'm recently CCT'd. I'm currently locuming until I sort of decide whereabouts in the country I'm going to live. But, you know, I work 1 day a week for an admission avoidance team. I do 3 days a week sort of clinically. I've got lots of other things that sort of interest me that are on the side. And it's the flexibility of GP is really beautiful. And I don't think a portfolio career should be looked upon negatively at all. It's actually a way to kind of have longevity in this career. I could talk to you for hours. We could carry on this for ages, but we probably do have to wrap it up because the listeners at home eventually are gonna get bored. So I guess my final question to you is, have you got any advice for anybody who's thinking about getting involved in leadership, who doesn't really know how to get their foot in the door? What advice would you give them?
Oh, good question. So I think ultimately it comes down to the sort of what we touched upon at the start, which was you don't necessarily need a role or a position to do some of this leadership stuff. It is about keeping your eyes open. It is about spotting that problem or that thing that could work a little bit better. And then actually having a go at trying to change that and trying to engage the people that you're working alongside to join you on that change journey, so to speak, to get you from A to B. In sort of specifically, that there are two things that I've found really helpful in the past, and in particular over the past 12 months, almost sort of hurdles that I've managed to get myself almost over, so to speak, that have been really helpful. The first one of which is, don't be afraid to reach out to other people and say, you know what, do you mind, can I grab half an hour to pick your brains about X or Y? Like, this is something that for me at least, feels really uncomfortable. The thought of sort of seeing someone speak at a conference, or you'd be in a meeting and someone would say something, you think, oh, that's really interesting. The thought of reaching out to them and just being like, hello, I'm really interested in what you do. Have you got half an hour for me? It's so uncomfortable. But if you can jump that hurdle and hit send on that email that you've already written in your head, let's be honest, like if you can get over that hurdle, it can be really powerful. Like as I've tried to do it a bit more and more, I've learned so much from so many people through doing it. And loads of opportunities have come up from doing so. So that's something I would strongly recommend. And secondly, another hurdle that's really hard to get over is the sort of don't let the thought that there's always somebody better to do this than me. Like, don't let that stop you from doing things, because if you do, then nothing will ever get done. If you can, again, it's another hurdle to jump, but when you can get over it and you can say, you know what, I'm going to give this a go, you'll find that most of the time you are the best person to be doing it, because you've clearly spotted a problem. You're clearly interested and engaged enough to want to give it a go. So you're probably actually, despite what you think, the best person to give it a shot. And the worst thing is, and I've done this a few times, the worst thing that can possibly happen is you do something that isn't completely successful. And even then, you've probably learned so much from trying to give it a go, and you'll no doubt have loads to take into the next thing that you want to do. So they're probably the two biggest things for me. Don't be afraid to sort of reach out, and don't let there's somebody better than me to do this stop you from doing some of the things you want to do. I don't know about you, Kim. Have you got any advice that you would give to listeners?
Anyone that knows me probably knows that I love giving advice. But advice is to be listened to, but not necessarily taken. But I entirely agree with you. And I think the narrative of, oh, so they must be better than me, you know, all those. I had this narrative before I did the Dardy Fellowship. I thought, oh my goodness, there's no way I could do that. They must be brilliant. They must have, you know, they're just, it's the brilliant thing about doing something like that. And probably the same with the National Medical Directors Fellowship, is that these are brilliant, inspiring, really interesting people. And they were definitely my, I remember Becky Malby, who runs the Dardy Fellowship, often used to say, find your yes people. And I think that's what doing those fellowships really kind of opens those doors, is finding your yes people. You find like-minded, interesting people, but you realize they're not that much different to you. They're just people who have got a bit of tenacity. They're just a bit, they're interested, and they've just thought, you know what, I'll give this a go. And we're all as surprised as each other to be there.
Indeed. I think what we're saying there to listeners is, okay, if there's anyone out there who has an idea or a thought bubbling in their head and they've been thinking for some time, oh, should I do this? I probably shouldn't. There's maybe someone better than me. Like, actually, there isn't. Just pick it up, give it a go, and let us know how you get on. It'd be great to hear.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is that far less people apply for these things than you think. So a lot of the things that I've done, there's not that many people interested in it. And actually, if you're interested in it, then actually somewhat, you know, there will be a role for you somewhere. So give these things a go. My other top tip is to become a yes person. So I think you do have to be a bit of a yes person, particularly at the start. I think then you swiftly have to become a no person and know your own boundaries and start to sort of protect your free time, etc. But I think initially you need to be a yes person just to kind of open some doors and find out whether you like it or not. You know, if leadership isn't for, I think big leadership roles aren't for everybody. Some people don't enjoy them, and that's okay. But until you've tried it, you will never know. And I think there's an awful lot of, you mentioned talking to people, but there's also an awful lot of opportunities on social media. So I highly recommend people being on Twitter for work purposes only. I stopped following Justin Bieber and other celebrities a long time ago because it ruins the purpose of it. But if you follow it for work purposes only, there's some fantastic opportunities on there. And it's amazing how you can reach out and contact, as you say, like-minded people. So they would be my tips. And obviously, yet anybody, any of the listeners wants to find out a bit more, I'm sure Liam, you're open to people getting in touch with you, as am I. But yeah, we're just two people who are a little bit interested, who are navigating this world like everybody else. But as long as we're enjoying it, that's the main thing. I think as soon as you start to not enjoy it, then that's when you need to change tack slightly.
Indeed.
Indeed. Oh, Liam, have you got anything else to add before we wrap up?
I think we've covered loads, so we should probably let our listeners go.
Exactly.
Just to say thank you for having me. I love these sort of conversations. I've learned so much from speaking to other people and listening to other people. So if there's one or two things that people pick up from listening today, then I think that's brilliant.
Oh, well, Liam, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I can't wait to see where you go and where you end up. And I'm sure that will be a path with a lot of different interesting things. But maybe we'll have you back on in the not so distant future to see what else you're getting up to.
That sounds good to me. It'd be great to chat again.
So welcome back, everybody. And hi, Kim. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you, LJ?
Yeah, good, good. I really enjoyed this episode for lots of reasons, but I suppose my first and overwhelming thing I want to say to you is how exciting the whole thing is in terms of sort of how, as a GP trainee, Liam's managed to build up such a portfolio already. It sounds really exciting as a GP trainee myself, working on doing the same thing. And as somebody who's recently CCT'd and as a GP registrar built their portfolio so well, I just found the whole thing so exciting.
Oh, no, yes, it was really interesting to have a chat with Liam. It was like sitting down with a friend over a cup of tea, apart from it was over Zoom. But he, he's a really inspirational kind of person, really. He's very passionate and he's done incredibly well. And he's also very humble and very kind of down to earth and would never probably talk about it, but he has achieved a lot in a very short period of time, and has really used every opportunity to kind of follow his interests and build his CV, not because he has to, but because he really wants to. And so it was really interesting sitting down and having a chat with him.
I think that's the sense I got from both of you, actually, is that it's about, I think you said that the phrase is about the journey and not the destination, and about sort of having that journey and going through like the applications and then the failures and then the successes and all the really exciting things that can come from a journey within, especially within leadership, I think, and that people love enthusiasm. And that's definitely what I picked up from the interview. And I hope that our listeners heard it too. I wonder if I could ask you a bit about your work as well with the FMLM. I know that you've worked with the Faculty of Medical Leadership and Management yourself, and Liam mentioned the National Medical Director Scheme, and it sounds like a really exciting organisation and lots of opportunities abound.
Yeah, so I met Liam because I was the London representative for the trainee steering group for the Faculty of Medical Leadership and Management. It's a bit of a mouthful, but Liam had been quite heavily involved in Next Generation GP in Cambridge and was really kind of involved in setting up their series. And, you know, as it always happens, through a connection, they said, oh, you're thinking of doing a webinar series as part of the trainee steering group for the Faculty of Medical Leadership and Management. You should speak to Liam Loftus. He did a very similar thing with the Next Generation GP, and he was unbelievably helpful and supportive, and really kind of was a big part of getting that webinar series set up. And then he, on the back of that, applied for a National Medical Director's Clinical Fellowship, which also sits sort of under FMLM, and so we came across each other again. But he so we've both kind of dabbled in different areas of different leadership fellowships, but they're just fantastic opportunities for those interested to really get involved in leadership and find out whether or not it's your thing, whether or not you like it, quite an early stage of your training. And then if you're passionate about it and you've had a good year like he has, then it might even land you kind of a different, you know, a role afterwards, which is what's happened in his case. So I think some people do these fellowships and love them, some people do them and think that's not for me, and both of that's okay. It's really important, it's about finding out really what you're interested in and what you're good at and maybe what you need to work on.
So I think the overarching feeling I get about a portfolio career is that it's so complementary to your clinical one. So it doesn't have to take away from your clinical career or your clinical pathway, but it can sort of help make it better and build it up more. And I think that in this case of leadership, that whole other perspective of healthcare that you get from doing a fellowship like this, in this particular instance, there was that that policy element of things and sort of seeing things from a very high systems level versus what you do sort of day to day, your GP room. But actually that perspective that you gain from doing something a bit different is really, really valuable, it sounds like.
Yeah, for me, it's what stops me getting burnt out. So it really is. It's less about, it's probably to an extent a selfish thing in that I think I've learned what I need in order to survive, but not just survive. Because I think we talk about surviving being a GP, and actually it's not about surviving, it's about thriving. And it's about finding out what you need in order to thrive in this career. And that's what I think is beautiful about GP, is that there's a huge opportunity to do all sorts of different things. And that might be working 1-2 days a week and looking after your family the rest of the time, or that might be working a few days a week and doing something else that interests you. Either way, you find what makes you like this job. And for me, it's doing the clinical work and seeing kind of frontline medicine, but then actually getting involved in kind of behind the scenes of, well, how do we make the system better? What can we do to kind of improve this, and more kind of, you know, policy and management stuff. So for me, it really stops me getting burnt out. And just by if I was to just do GP, I would probably find myself kind of getting a bit bored and a bit stressed. But the way that I can kind of run other interests alongside it just keeps my toes in different things and keeps me happier. I find that after 3 days of clinical GP, I don't like the person I become if I'm to go back in and do a fourth day. Like, candidly, I think my temper's shorter. I think I'm kind of, I've done too much, basically. So, but I'm happy to work full time. I can't do more than 3 days a week GP. So to be able to channel my interests into either other areas of clinical medicine or management leadership stuff is what keeps me ticking.
And I think I share that side of wanting to do something as well as and different from to sort of stop me from getting burnt out. My particular area of interest is medical education. So I have a role doing that alongside my GP training, and I find that they complement each other really well. I'm definitely a better teacher / better doctor for having done the other one. And I know that that's something I really enjoy. And it might seem like I feel like sometimes I'm doing four different jobs at once, but actually, when it comes down to it, I'm really enjoying my training, knowing that it's not just clinical stuff, which, you know, again, for lots of people, that's more than enough. And for me, full-time GP training was definitely more than enough, which is actually why I went less than full-time to do something else. But yeah, I suppose I don't have a children, or I'm not married or anything yet. Fingers crossed. But I suppose when a family starts getting put into it and other personal bits start coming into play, I'll probably have to cut down a little bit more.
Well, yeah. And it's also, I think sometimes we've got this narrative in medicine that you can only cut down if you're going to do something else, whether that be academic medicine, whether that be like leadership, have a family. I think it's absolutely okay to go part-time just to kind of be you and have your time off, and it's okay to sit and watch Netflix on your days off. That's okay. There is this narrative that you need, you know, well, what are you doing with the rest of your time? And actually you do what you need to do in order to thrive in this career, and you balance it however that may be. And you know, kudos to the people that are GP partners and work 10 sessions a week. That will never be me. I'll get to an early grave. But if you can do that, great. And if you enjoy it, great. But you do what you need to do to thrive in this career. Because it really, I think what I've learned in 6 months post-CCT is you can just do what you want. It's unbelievable flexibility. So yeah, 6 months in post-CCT, absolutely zero regrets right now. So to anybody who's, I think sometimes there's a lot of negative narrative around ST3 and, oh gosh, everybody hates the job. And I have zero regrets. So yeah, if that's what you need to hear today, then I hope that helps.
It's certainly what I need to hear as I stare AKT down the barrel. So that's coming, and I'm not looking forward to it. So thank you. It's right at the end of the tunnel. So I suppose one question that I wrote down when I was writing my notes for this episode was when you ask people how they get to where they are, and, you know, how did you find yourself here? How did you get these opportunities? Did you design your career like this? And often the answer is no, it's pretty much opportunistic. I just asked enough questions and met the right people, and then I just sort of fell into it. And that can feel really unsatisfactory for people sort of like at the very beginning of that, of those stages of their career, who haven't yet developed those networks, and they just want a pathway. It can feel really frustrating. And I know that's probably how I felt maybe a few years ago. And I don't know, I wonder what you think about that, whether you ever felt like that when you asked people how they got to where they were, and whether you sort of have developed how your ideas have changed about how you sort of build yourself and build your career.
Yeah, I think probably a few years ago, I thought you had to kind of get one job and then that was it. And once you got that job, it was this path, this linear path upwards. And then it was lit, and everything had to be a progression. And actually, I think it's very okay. I mean, I still class myself as very much down the bottom of the ladder in terms of a leadership journey. But I think it's okay to go linear, and it's okay to kind of think, oh, well, I don't know much about that. I'm going to go and find out about that and see if I like it, learn what skills I need to learn, and move on. And not everything has to be a step up. Particularly in medicine, when you're juggling sort of clinical medicine alongside it, I think you can't. But I think there is a beautiful space between being involved in leadership and being in clinical that is filled by a unique set of people with a unique set of skills. And I think we're very fortunate, if you're interested in leadership, to be able to kind of fill in that grey area, but work with fantastic managers. I mean, I do some action learning sets for the NHS Graduate Management Scheme, and I think doctors don't really know about that scheme, but these are hugely unbelievable people. They have over 20,000 people apply for, I think the scheme now takes about 500 people a year. It's unbelievably competitive. And these are the next generation of leaders in the NHS. Yet as a junior doctor, you don't find out about them, you don't know about them, you never come across them. So there's some very exciting people that work in the NHS who are incredibly talented. And you know, that is required, but as is this middle ground of people that are interested in leadership and also interested, you know, have clinical frontline knowledge as well. I think you have to be a bit tenacious. I think if you're interested in something, I mean, you demonstrate this probably even more than I do, but you really, if you're interested in something, you have to go and pursue it and like push it. And no one is going to hand you this stuff on a plate. You have to kind of show an interest. You have to knock on a lot of doors. You have to have a lot of doors closed in your face. You have to apply for a lot of jobs and be rejected from a lot of jobs. I mean, I think the last five things I've applied for, I haven't even been shortlisted for. But they always say, if you have never been rejected from a job, then you haven't applied for the right job, probably, because you've got, it's about kind of stretching yourself occasionally. So yeah, that'd be my few thoughts. But I think if you want something, go get it, and eventually some doors will open that will lead you to the right place, I think, or even possibly lead you to a place that you least expected. There's a lot of, you know, people that have ended up in careers or areas of specialism that they never thought they would get into, but one thing's led to another. So yeah, I think it's not linear. There's no straightforward answer, but just do what makes you happy.
I think the my best successes and unexpected sort of turns have come from places of failure and then sidestepping and then working my way up from the sidestep. Do you see what I mean? Again, listeners, you can't see me gesticulating wildly, but I'm sidestepping and climbing.
Yeah, it's like a dance routine. It's great. It just needs a soundtrack. Produce a thing. But no, I agree. Like, failing, it's about reframing what failure is. And I think the problem is doctors are perfectionists. Everybody, you know, it attracts perfectionists. And therefore, I think people might have this fear of failure and this need to be the best at everything, and that's never going to happen. And actually, you don't have to be the best, you just have to do your best, and that's okay. And I think, you know, you're never going to find out really what you're capable of until you've failed and then found your own path. So yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's a lovely way to perhaps finish this particular bookend. Have you got anything else you'd like to add? Any more inspirational words, Kim?
Oh, I'm a fan of an inspirational quote, I have to admit. But no, it was just really, really interesting to talk to Liam. He's a really down-to-earth, lovely guy who is doing fantastic things in the world of clinical leadership. And watch this space, because I'm sure he'll go on to do fascinating things.
Perhaps we can get him back on the podcast in a couple of years' time when he's running the NHS or something.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll give him a bit longer. Maybe give him 5.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. We hope you enjoyed this this podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for coming. Bye.
Do 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 do.